From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is Jek Aristotle Ballou. She is a rider and horse trainer of great renown and the author of several books, including Equine Fitness and The Unscheduled Dismount. The latter book is a collection of amusing stories of horses and their human companions, drawn largely from her blog at jekballou.com. But before you rush to your computer to check it out, please note that the author is right here with me. Jek Ballou, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you become a horsewoman?
Well, I was actually lucky enough to be raised by horse trainers in central Vermont. So I grew up around them. My parents
always
were both trainers.
Rode when you were a little girl?
Yeah, and I was one of those little girls that was afflicted with horse craziness from the start. My brother missed that gene. He has nothing to do with horses, but
why do you think? What is it? Why is it? Why do you think girls are more horse crazy?
Well, I mean, percentage-wise, I'm not sure. Stereotypically, it is girls, but I don't know how much of a fact that really is. I mean, in the U.S., it's more of a girl's thing to do, but globally, that's not the case. I've spent a lot of time studying overseas, and in Portugal, it's very cool to do if you're a young boy. It's the in thing. So it's very different over there. But my trainer there says if it's in your blood, it's in your blood.
Well, I was watching the Olympics, and although they were a bit harder to find on TV than women's beach volleyball,
yes.
there were some great equestrian events at the Olympics. And there are as many women, even more women riding than men, although that wasn't the case a few years ago. It was mostly men.
Yeah, that's the neat thing about horses is it's really, you see people doing it later in life. And there is, depending on the different disciplines, there's often an equality between the genders, which is pretty neat to see.
Yeah. I was so impressed with the dressage classes at the Olympics. I mean, they were amazing. And so you know all about this. So how do you get a horse to, first of all, how does the rider communicate to the horse? And secondly, how as a trainer do you get a horse to pirouette and pee off and all those things that they do?
Well, there was a trainer in Germany once who said brilliantly, it takes about 10 years to become a good rider. And then takes another 10 to learn how to teach the horse to do those things. Some people would say it takes a lifetime. But when it's done well, as you saw in the Olympics, you shouldn't see the rider doing much. It should look like they're just sitting there. That's when it's done correctly. In reality, they're doing tons of little isometric contractions and shifting their weight. But to get a horse to do something seemingly unnatural, like a canter pirouette or these flying changes of leg that they do, it takes years of it's very progressive. It takes years of layering one skill on top of another. And for that reason, it really does require the right kind of horse that has the mentality as well as the physical ability to do those things and enjoys doing those things.
Well, for instance, let's take that pee off that the horses are,
yeah.
They're sitting in one, those of you who don't know, they're standing in one spot and they are running, or they're trotting in one spot. How in the world would you, that particular skill, how would you ever get a horse to do that?
Well, you start by teaching the horse to flex its hind legs one at a time. You always start from the ground, well, almost always from the ground, so you're not in the saddle.
So you're doing groundwork. You're standing on the ground.
Yeah.
And what, do you have a rope around the horse's leg or what?
No, you just hold the horse with either the bridle reins or with a lead rope. And you have a very long whip so you can reach the back legs, and you teach it to lift one leg and then the other. And then over the time, you ask him to do it a little quicker, and then you ask him to start lifting the front legs. And then you put a rider on top, but you still have somebody on the ground and kind of wean them off the person on the ground. And actually, that movement, it does seem like something that's just has no practical application, but it came from war. So it was necessary for your horse to be ready to get out of Dodge, but you needed your hands free to be in combat. So that's where a lot of the movements have come from.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, is that true with dressage in general, that it has its roots in war and horse warfare?
Yeah, the earliest treatise we have was from Xenophon, who was, in addition to being a great horseman, he was a a military leader. So he first wrote down how to train the horse for these maneuvers, which at that time had their application in combat, hand-to-hand combat.
But we don't do that.
We no longer do that. So it's become something for a noble pastime.
I was in France once, and I went to this demonstration, and I couldn't understand what they were saying because it was all in French. But they had the horses lying down so they could use them as a, you know, to put their guns on. I don't know what you call that. It's not natural, is it, to train a horse to lie down? How would you train a horse to lie down?
It's very against their nature. I mean, horses being prey animals, they don't want to
be around
laying
you
down under a predator, you know. So people that have the skill and communication to do that, it's neat to watch.
Yeah, it really is. Is breed, you were saying you have to have the horse that's inclined to do some of this stuff.
Yeah.
And how much of that is the breed of the horse? Do you think you can do the things that you do with any breed? It's the individual horse?
Absolutely. No, I believe you can do it with any breed. How good they will be, there does become a line at which certain breeds will excel. But yeah, all horses can do a Piaf, for example. But if you put, you know, a quarter horse next to a warm blood, and the warm bloods are what you see in the Olympics, there will be a difference in how they can perform the Piaf.
Yeah. Well, hey, we're talking with Jack Ballou, and she's a horse trainer and a writer, and she's written a couple of wonderful books. But before we get to your books, tell me, you were talking about, and I guess these are in your books, because you were talking about the isometrics and the things that the rider does. You said there's a series of things.
Yeah.
Can you get specific? What kinds of things does the rider do to communicate with the horse?
The first piece that riders learn to do is, and it's helpful if you start young when you're malleable, but you want to learn to follow the horse's movement. So by that I mean not just sit in balance on their body, but to have a fluidity about your posture that allows the horse's movement to come through your joints. So many people will sit on the horse and get a little bit rigid, and then the horse responds to that by getting rigid underneath you, as you can imagine. So the first thing that riders need to learn to do is to move in the right places in their body. So let their knee joints, for example, have a little motion and absorb the horse's motion. But then after you've learned to do that, then you need to learn to resist in the right way. It's kind of like martial arts in that sense. So then you need to help the horse improve its own body mechanics and body posture by the amount of tone that you put in your body, and you're constantly modulating that. So sometimes you're completely relaxed, and sometimes you're very firm but not tight. That makes sense.
Kind of. I went to the Olympics, the equestrian events in 1984 when they were in Los Angeles. And the riders that were riding then, although they still got marvelous results, they looked bad on their horses. There was kind of they would lean way back, a lot of the dressage riders, or they would hunch all over. I mean, they didn't seem all that concerned with their own equitation, as long as they were getting the horse to do what they want. But now, this year, like I was looking at, what was her name? She was so fantastic on Vallegro. Oh, Charlotte, whatever her name was.
Dujardin?
Yeah. She's amazing.
Yeah.
But like her equitation is really good.
Yeah.
I mean, she's like solid, straight, and tucked with their elbows. It changed? Has it undergone stylistic changing or not?
No, that's something that's really not changed. The judging in terms of how much they weight their scores for rider equitation have changed a little bit.
Mm.
The other thing too, though, that's happened in dressage is we, as an entire global dressage scene, are breeding better and better and better horses. So it's almost like in the NBA, if you had somebody over 6'5", you know, back in the day, that was a big deal. And now it's, if you don't have
everybody's
the entire squad over 6'5". So a similar thing has happened in the dressage world, where we are breeding horses that have extravagant movement. It's almost unnatural the way they move with their bodies. So it allows the rider, it could be argued that it allows the rider to sit, more perfectly without having to work so hard.
Because the horses are better?
because the movement is better. Mm-hmm. So the riders won't have to force themselves around in the saddle trying to create movement. It's already there in some senses. So.
But now in thoroughbred horse racing,
yes.
The breeding, the overbreeding has not been very good for the sport. That is, the horses are faster, but at the same time, they're not, they don't sustain. They're not as, you know, they break down more frequently and so forth. But the breeding in dressage horses has been better for the horse?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Why
the thoroughbred world is maybe not the best comparison, though, because there are some controversial training practices that happen that weaken the horse's structure. You know, it's like we're constantly chasing that faster and faster mile with horses, and we're not sure where the limit is yet. We may have already found it, mm-hmm. but we want to believe we can get faster and faster. But there are certain things at this point that are still legal to do to supplement horses that has been proven physiologically to weaken their bones and their supporting soft tissue, so they do break down.
But why would they want to do that? Just because the horse, that'll make the horse faster.
Yeah, there's a technique that delays fatigue, which basically involves just giving the horse a mixture of baking soda and water, and it buffers the lactic acid. But the problem with that is that while you're delaying fatigue, it's drawing important supporting structures out of the horse's bones and soft tissue, and they break their legs, they fall down, they stumble.
Well, is it harder for a horse to run as fast as they can for 3 minutes than it is for a horse to go through a 3-day event where they're jumping and they're doing dressage, they're doing obstacles on the trail and all that?
You know, I don't think so. The difference is they ask them to do it younger, so it is harder on them. I mean, a racehorse in our industry is done by the time they're 4, they're retired. Mm-hmm. And 3-day eventing, you wouldn't even get your horse out there.
Till they were 10.
At 4. I mean, I'm not even sure it's legal, actually. In mm-hmm. dressage, we have rules that you can't compete hard at that young of an age, so.
Yeah, now, so what about you? I know you're a trainer and you're a rider. What kind of riding do you do?
So my passion is in dressage. I love dressage. But I really love applying dressage to different disciplines, different sports, different breeds. So I really enjoy using the principles of dressage, which those are, to create the most balanced, well-moving equine athlete that you can. And everybody needs that, no matter what they're doing, if they're a Western rider or a trail rider, etc. So I enjoy helping people from all different disciplines help their horses move better and carry themselves better. But in addition to dressage, I myself still do long-distance competitive trail riding when I have the time. I really enjoy just being out in nature with a horse. There's nothing quite like that. But I come from a combined driving event background. That's what my father does. And that's what
putting them in a buggy, you mean?
And then, if that's not crazy enough, driving cross country through obstacles.
In a cart?
Insanity. Yes, yes, yes.
Well, so how do you get over an obstacle if you're in a cart?
Well, nowadays they have these really high-tech four-wheel carriages with hydraulic braking systems, and the wheels are designed to kind of bump off trees and not get hung up on them. I mean, back when I was my father's navigator, we didn't have this luxury. We got hung up on tree roots and you'd tip your cart over all the time. But it's a crazy sport. It's a crazy sport.
Well, let me ask a little bit about the horses. We're talking with Jack Aristotle Blue, and she's a horse trainer and rider and author. How smart are horses? You know, that's a debate,
that depends,
right?
Depends who you ask. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm asking you.
They're not smart in the way we typically define smarts. I was a philosophy major in college, and one of the things we often talked about was, you know, do animals have the same consciousness we do? And it's one of those questions you could bat around forever. Horses are definitely more present than we are, and I tend to think that translates to smarts, to intelligence, but they're not cognitive in the way that we are, and I think that's how we often use the word smart.
I mean, do you have an idea of what it's like in a horse's head?
I'm getting better. I'd like to think I'm getting better at it. Yeah, the more horses I train, definitely, the way their thought processes work. And they're all so different, and that's what's hard with training horses because, as I said in the beginning, it's hard enough to learn how to train a horse. But then to get to the place where you realize how individual they are, I guess it's probably like being a great school teacher. It's like, how do you reach the different personalities and levels of skittishness or bullies, or they're all so different.
And of course, you're also, as you encounter horses, you're encountering their rider at the same time, right?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I work a lot with the rider and how to help them train their horse.
And do you tell people if they can't ride to get off their horse and sell their horse and forget about it?
I've only done that one time, and it was somebody who was honestly terrified. She was so terrified. She was so terrified that she would just work herself up into an anxious state, and I told her, this is probably not the sport for you.
Well, now, you look very fit, and I think a lot of people don't think of horse as a fitness kind of thing. I mean, they think, well, you're just sitting on the horse is doing all the work, right? But so you think fitness and riding go together?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's like we were talking about before, when it's done correctly, you shouldn't see the rider moving a lot. And that's the secret. You know, it looks like they're not doing anything, but it's a serious workout. And when you're sitting the trot, I mean, sometimes your stomach muscles are just on fire. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like fun. Let's rush out there and set our stomachs on fire. Let's talk a little bit about your books. Now, there's a third one I know that I don't have in front of me, 101 Dressage Exercises.
Yes.
So that's like someone could get, even though they can't get you, I mean, a lot of people can come and see you and do a clinic with you.
Right, right.
But if they're not in, you just finished one in New England.
Yeah, yes? A clinic. Mm-hmm.
But if they don't happen to be with you, they can still get your aid by checking out this book. I mean, would a layman horse person be able to look at this book and say, oh, I could try this?
Absolutely. And that was the whole point of that book. It came out in 2005, and it came from me having this harebrained idea that's exactly what the horse world needed, was something very, very practical, because there are a plethora of books that have information on how to train your horse and the theory behind all these different things and the philosophies and different people's opinions and on and on and on. And I said, you know what we need? We need something that's just insanely easy to follow. It's, you know, it has a picture, it has the point, it has the steps, and it doesn't exist. And I approached my publisher, and they thought, well, we'll give it a try. I don't know. And it has been so successful. And I run into people all over the country that say, oh my gosh, this is exactly what the horse world needed. It's so easy to follow. So yeah, you really do not need to be sophisticated. You don't need a trainer.
You do need a horse, though.
You need a horse. Okay. You do need a horse.
I can't just do it.
You can borrow somebody's.
I can't just do it on my chair in the living room. That's what I need. But and then you have this one that I have in front of me called Equine Fitness, a conditioning program of exercises and routines for your horse. What will people find in here? I'm going to hold it up to the microphone so people can see.
Okay, so people can see it. Yeah.
What will you find in here?
Okay, that book is sort of the distillation of my journey as a horse person, and here's how it came about. When I was raised by my two parents that were horse trainers in different disciplines, my mother's also a dressage rider and my father's a carriage driver, and I was at that time doing long distance endurance racing, and that's, we were all doing very different things, but we trained our horses exactly the same. We all did the same thing with our respective horses on a weekly basis. So fast forward 20 years, and I see people specializing before the horse even has a solid foundation in anything. And that's kind of the human nature, is, you know, hurry up and try to get the job done, cut out steps. And what I find over and over and over is that people, riders, are stuck at a certain level or frustrated and can't accomplish something simply because the horse is not physically able or prepared to do what they're asking. It's not that they don't have the skills or the understanding. It's that their body is weak or crooked or stiff or all of the above.
Can't you get a horse to do something that you wanted to do, that, and it will look as though the horse is doing it, even though they're not actually doing it? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, you can get a horse to say, to collect, to look as though they're collected without actually being collected.
Only to a certain point. No, yeah. Only to a certain point. And the rider will realize, I can't, you know, get it to be collected anymore. And so what that means is the horse doesn't have those big you know, animated prancy steps that we all seek. And like I said, most of the time that's not because the rider doesn't know how to ask. It's really because the horse's hindquarter muscles are not strong enough, or they're not even enough on each side of the horse. So I find I was like a broken wheel teaching this stuff over and over and over. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to write it down again in very simple layman's terms, because this information's out there, but it's in veterinary books, which I like to geek out on, but not everybody's going to sit around and read this stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what that book has been, and people, it found its market. People are very grateful for the information that's in there.
Now, a lot of horse trainers, I think, or some horse trainers, of the, say, Horse Whisperer or Monty Roberts variety,
yes,
would want to kind of keep their, they want to keep their secrets. They don't want to really explain how they do the magic that they do, so that people will continue to pay them to come and do it. But you want everybody to see how to do it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I guess maybe it's not that magical what I'm doing. I don't know. Nobody's made a movie about me yet. So.
Well, now, do you, when you see that Horse Whisperer kind of stuff, and there's sometimes a kind of a, those things kind of come in and out of fashion, like everybody's doing this thing and everybody's doing that thing. What is your take on those things?
There are incredible horsemen out there, like the movie Buck. I mean, absolutely, for real. To see somebody at that level of mastery, especially being able to reach what I call troubled horses, but horses that have certain challenges that are not straightforward to work with, it is incredible. But you're right, there are fads that come and go in the horse world, like with anything, and that's what makes it so confusing. And that's where horses and riders get derailed, as with anything, like exercise programs, diet information, right? And then everybody has their opinions, and then as a rider, you get all mixed up. You got all this stuff swirling around your head. So mostly what I try to do is help people get back to the simple information that really doesn't change. It's foundational.
And so you studied philosophy.
Yes.
You're a writer, and you're a writer as well. How did you begin writing? Because you have a blog, and you have this one, the book that I just spent the week reading, and it's so much fun. It's called The Unscheduled Dismount, which happens to be my most frequent dismount, I have to say. And it's a wonderful book of, you know, I guess short stories, not creative nonfiction stories, I guess you call them, about your life with horses and the people who ride them. So how did you become a writer?
Well, I always thought I would be a writer, and I've always enjoyed writing. And at college, I considered majoring in writing, and I had the very great privilege before going to college, I did an independent study in high school. And Maxine Kuman, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, happened to be a horse person and was burning to take lessons with my parents. So they said, well, we will trade you lessons if you work with our daughter in poetry. So I had the very, very good fortune of working with this incredible poetry teacher who became a mentor to me. And she told me, don't you dare go major in English or writing. And I said, well, why not? You know, if I'm going to be a writer, isn't that what I have to do? And she said, no, because you're going to be like one of those people that graduates and they try to write about their life experience at 22. She said, the best thing you can do is go out and get life experience. So I majored in philosophy, which is, I don't know, to me, philosophy is everything, right? It's all the subjects rolled into one. And I'm glad I followed her advice. So I've been out on a journey still writing, but not getting all narrow focused about it.
Well, do you think your philosophy background has helped you as a horse trainer?
Yeah, I do. I do, because it's helpful if you can look at things from different angles with horses. And that's kind of all you ever do in philosophy. Let's examine this a different way. So,
I was asking you about breeds earlier. Tell me a little bit about the differences in the horses that you work with. You know, what do you see out there?
Okay, that's a great question, because it seems like there's new breeds cropping up every day.
Yeah.
So in dressage, you typically see what we call warm blood, which is kind of a blanket term for horses that originate from Europe, to simplify things. And they're big horses, long-legged, decent.
They're from a draft horse stock?
Yeah, way back in the day, it would have been something cold-blooded that was sort of drafty, bred to something sort of hot-blooded like an Arabian.
Mm-hmm.
And now each country has their own kind of brand of warm blood. You get German warm blood, Dutch warm blood, et cetera, et cetera. So those horses, we've bred them finer and finer, so they have a lot of suspension, which is basically hang time in the air when they trot, so it looks like they float across the ground.
Like we saw in the Olympics.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where warm blood shine. They shine in dressage. A lot of times they'll be used for eventing if they have good stamina as well. So you can contrast that with America's most famous breed, which is the quarter horse, which is bred, you don't want them to have a lot of suspension, because if you're working cattle or if you're doing really quick maneuvers, that suspension is your downfall. So they need to be a lot quicker on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have that hang time. A lot of times they don't cover as much ground with their stride. They don't have the same, we call suppleness, but the same looseness in their bodies. So those are two probably breeds that a lot of your listeners have heard.
And then there's Arabs.
And then Arabians, which I'm very partial to.
Uh-huh.
They really excel at distance for good reason. I mean, that is an animal that no breed can touch in long distance. And they certainly can do dressage. You see them out there. They sometimes lack the strength, the sheer physical strength, to excel at the higher movements like Piaf and canter pirouettes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They try, though. That's the thing about Arabs.
Yeah.
They try. You can't tell them they can't do it.
Do you think that one breed, I know, is their ability to concentrate different?
The ability to put their mind on something, Arabians are very much excel at that. Warmbloods, many people have that perception that they can put their mind on it, but the thing about warmbloods is they're so quiet in nature that they will allow you to drill them repetitively. It's not the same to me as concentrating, but
mm-hmm.
they have that quiet demeanor where you can drill a pattern or an exercise over and over. I mean, generally speaking, there are obviously exceptions.
Do horses want to, would horses rather just lay in the
swat flies. Do they
want to do the stuff that you're at? I mean, does it excite them to get their mind working and make them do these
many
things?
Horses it does, but I also believe too, again, it comes down to a breed thing. Horses that have really evolved with people, like the Arabians or the Andalusians in Spain,
mm-hmm.
I mean, many times the Arabians live in the tents with families out in the desert. So they're very friendly horses. They're very trusting of people generally. And they do really take a shine to work. And when they're not in an exercise program, many times they're very listless. But then there are the more wild breeds, you know, like Mustangs or breeds that are just closely removed from them that haven't had the same domestication. And they're different. You know, I think they are perfectly happy just munching grass and swatting flies and
leave them alone.
Yeah, they're like, this is good here. What we're doing.
Tell us a little bit about your website.
The website is always a work in progress. The website there is, it has, you know, a good bio. I'm hoping over time for it to be more of a community, a more living space. But for now, what I like about the website is that it's very interactive for the calendar, for people to look at information and or register for things. And I'm also on the National Advisory Board for the Western Dressage Association. So
mm-hmm.
this is a new sport. It's a whole new sport that just started in 2010. So where we're taking these breeds that I'm telling you have not typically had a place in the real world, quote unquote, dressage. And they have their own sport now and their own place to shine and compete. So my website reflects that I'm doing a lot to get that off the ground and spread the word on that.
And we can also find your blog there.
And my blog is there, which is mostly humorous stories about life with horses, because at the end of the day, we have to be having fun, because why else are we doing this?
My guest, Jack Aristotle Ballou. She has written several books, including 101 Dressage Exercises, Equine Fitness, a conditioning program of exercises and routines for your horse, The Unscheduled Dismount, and Other Humor from a Life with Horses. Jack Ballou, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. I want to thank our guest, Jack Aristotle Ballou. Her books include 101 Dressage Exercises, Equine Fitness, and The Unscheduled Dismount. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.